Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and the Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, the Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, the Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. Welcome to this episode of The Grower and the Economist. Peter and I are joined by guest expert Alice Hill. I had the opportunity to meet Alice in June at the Rural Grocers Conference in Wichita, Kansas, where she presented on her production operation that feeds her entire town, and she runs a grocery store 2 days a week to get that food to the consumers. And so we've talked a lot about producing as small growers, and we've always handed that baton off or asked how we get into grocery or into customers' houses. And it's fascinating to have Alice here to tell us everything she does.
Thank you very much.
So before we jump into everything we're going to talk about, we'd just love to get to know you a little bit better, how you ended up here. Have you always been a grower? Have you always been interested in food and nutrition?
Yes to all of that. I am in Luray, Kansas now. My majority of my life was spent in Northwest Kansas, which is a much harsher growing zone than Luray. And that prepared me for a lot of knowledge to be able to apply to what I'm doing now. My husband and I were farmer ranchers in Northwest Kansas. We raised cattle, dry land wheat, ran a hunting lodge, did a lot of different things. We transitioned to organic wheat at one point, which really made a big difference in our economic scale of things. And it fit what we believed in. We had seen the change from what you would call traditional farming methods to the chemical methods of today. And it truly bothered us to see that happening. We wanted to take a stand and do what we could. At the same time I was growing gardens, I was also became a registered nurse. So I gained some nutrition background, which reinforced, in my opinion, how vital it is that the food we eat nurtures our bodies versus harms our bodies. And the American diet today is a sad state of affairs, and we are seeing the repercussions of that. So throughout every facet of my life, I have tried to connect the dots with nutrition, local food production, the economics that creates, the self-sufficiency that creates. For a while, I was a school nurse, and I was able to work with the little kiddos to help them see that so much of their lives are dependent and reliant upon food trucks, and that they have the capability in their rural communities not to have that happen.
Well, I cannot agree more with this idea that diversified farms have the opportunity to improve the economics, to increase self-sufficiency, to improve nutrition, and to improve the environment. And they are harder, and they are harder from a work perspective and a people perspective. But I think that the combination of all of those benefits you have just talked about more than outweigh the costs. And it's often an upward battle trying to, you know, have that conversation and really draw people in and be able to prove it. So I am completely aligned with that and think it's amazing that you're doing this work and, you know, another voice for this discussion.
Well, thank you. And one of the things I like to point out to people, and I do have the knowledge base to say what it feels like to sit on a tractor, listening to the roar of the engine, worrying about the cost of diesel, the cost of all of the things that you're doing, not just economic costs, but environmental costs, worrying about the mega loan at the bank to keep that tractor running. That's work. That's a strain on your psyche. It's a strain on your emotions. It's a strain on your marriage. There's so many factors that when you talk about working, that gardening is hard work. It is hard work. The flip side of that is if you're on your hands and knees pulling weeds, listening to the birds, smelling the soil, feeling the wind across your face. There's no debt. It is a different level of work that at the end of the day, you go to bed content. You feel satisfied. You don't feel as though you are working for a system that is intending to break you. We went through the farm crisis of the 80s. We got married in 1975, started out in terrible debt, had two little babies, and lost everything. Started back over again. So my background really does give validity to the fact that the current agricultural system, it's right up there with slavery. It truly is. And we are, I'm afraid, trapped unless we break free intentionally. In Luray, is that we can break free intentionally and pull back onto a smaller scale.
And I love what you're saying. You're number one, you're taking me back to my childhood here in East, Northeast Massachusetts on a truck farm. So your description of the tractor, and you know, it's, I'm so fortunate that as I was growing up through my early years and my teenage years, all I needed to worry about, Alice, was the smell of the fuel and the soil, where my dad and mom ran the farm and they worried about the other side of what you were describing. And I think with your introduction, Alice, you can see immediately what drew Michelle and myself together, where she brings that business side to the conversation and table, and I bring the grower and the researcher side. So you're essentially, you're defining why we put this podcast together, to bring these two worlds to our fellow small farmers and greenhouse operators who need to be the jack of all trades, right?
Yes, that's encouraging for me to hear that. Thank you. I'm glad we've met up.
Now you've taken it to another level at this stage in your career where, if I'm understanding correctly, you're not a traditional commercial farmer. Are you somewhere in between a hybrid of, say, a very advanced home gardener to a pre-commercial grower? How would you describe your position on the spectrum?
I'm not sure if I understand enough to be able to define it that way. I can just tell you what I'm doing. And I do need to not take too much credit. I am not feeding our entire town, but the potential is there for it to happen. I'm also want to say that I'm a voice for extremely small communities all across America, but those communities that are maybe under 300 people. We cannot change the corporate food system all in one big swell wave, but we can do it one little town at a time and at least regain, and that's what I'm hoping to demonstrate here, once we're completely self-sufficient. In fact, they were self-sufficient and then they would export, but we've lost all of that. So what my intent is, well, I will say this. I feel as though one grower, one strong, avid grower like myself, can produce enough food for 10 families. And I'm demonstrating that that's actually working here. In our little market, I'm the major vegetable producer. We have one other vendor that has a hydroponic system in a town north of us. They bring in lettuces and fresh greens all through the year, so we're able to be open all year round. My intent is that if I could find 10 more growers, similar to myself, younger hopefully, then we would be able to feed an area of 4 townships, which is about 300 people. If we did that, that would be a demonstration that this is possible. We also run a small cow-calf herd again. What we have recognized is the only solution to small farming is direct marketing. And so we have direct market beef. I have 6 pigs, so we'll be selling direct market pork. We have eggs. A friend is doing poultry on a small scale. All of these things, just one little niche at a time, can feed a small community.
Alice, we have had episodes in the past where we've debated and discussed well, how much of industrial agriculture, how much of a slice of the pie can we return to the community? And Michelle and guest experts have referenced that currently it's about 3% of the national production. And they told me, and it kind of deflated me when they said, gee, if we could get that doubled or tripled, that would be a big deal. And I walked away from the conversation with my tail between my legs saying, can't we do better than that? We used to do it. It was the majority before industrial ag. So it's so refreshing to hear you voice some of the things that we've been discussing and know that there are others that think this way and want to return some of agriculture to the family farm. Good for you. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I'm just one voice. I know there are many out there. One of the wonderful things is when you join an organization or group that has those feelers out so that they can help connect people and encourage each other. What my thoughts are is nothing unique, nothing novel. It's just a return to what we once had. On the one side that I have done something is I did strategic planning, which so often growers will say, well, I'm going to grow a whole bunch of something without having any idea whether or not there's a market for that whole bunch of something. And then they go to a farmer's market and five other people have a whole bunch of the same thing and no one does well. So in our little growing group here, we have a meeting at the beginning of the year saying, all right, who's going to focus on this? Who will focus on that? We currently need more growers, but our consumer base is growing at the same pace as our grower base. As one thing becomes a little better, so does the other, and we're just moving our way up together. Last night, for instance, our market, we're only open for an hour and a half. We had standing room only in our little building. People from several different towns came to purchase things. They come intent to purchase. They are thrilled with the quality of the produce. It really demonstrated it's working. We made not quite $500, which is tiny. It's that little drop in a bucket. But for a community of our area, that it's significant to bring in $500 in locally produced food in less than an hour and a half.
That sounds wonderful. We've had guests on as the pandemic set in, Alice, here in Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts, where there was that same intent of cooperation among small farmers, sharing equipment or coordinating harvest and boxes for CSAs and whatnot.
Well, I want to go back to where you have this meeting at the beginning of growing season. And then, you know, you talk about what everybody wants to grow and divide it up. Because one of the hypotheses, I'll say, that I've been testing and really was a big part of my talk at the Rural Grocers Conference was about this idea that the benefit that small communities have, especially rural communities, is that there is the know-how and the space and so forth to be able to grow food. But I think that this communication that gives you a competitive advantage to compete against the larger system, that by having a sit down and talking about what everybody's going to grow, you don't overproduce one thing and drive the price down. You don't upset consumers because you don't have any sweet corn when they want it or whatever it is. And so my talk was focused on this idea that grocery stores understand what consumers want and they can work with farms to plan, but it does take planning. And it sounds like is aligned with what you're doing.
That's very true on a very small, small scale. Our first thing that we did when we started this market is just get a survey of our community. I needed to know, all right, are you all interested in having local food? Because nobody's done anything like this in this community. I moved into this community this is our fifth summer here, so I'm a newbie. And in Western Kansas, if you don't have seven generations behind you, you'll never really be part. But they were very welcoming. We did a survey. had a woman who was extremely helpful in getting that survey out all around town. What should we grow? What shouldn't we grow? Kohlrabi was not a big issue. So that gave us our first start. So it was easy to eliminate some things that maybe I might have wanted to grow, but if it wasn't going to be eaten, it would have done me no good. So then we determined what quantity would we need. And most of our community is either a couple, older couple, or a widow. Most of our people we are serving are older than I am. Since we started, one gentleman has lost his wife, but he comes in every single time we're open, sits, has coffee, visits. It's his social time. So we're serving a lot of different needs. When you're talking about working with a grocery store in order for farmers to grow for a grocery store, that's probably out of my range of knowledge base. I think it certainly could be done. I know grocers require a steady, consistent supply, which in some communities like ours, Kansas, it's a very hard growing environment. And unless you have protective growing environments or something that assures you are going to have that steady supply, it could be very tough.
Well, and that's a great transition to that protected space, because not only have you done your strategic plan and the questionnaires and set the foundation, but I understand that you've also done research and improved the tools that you have to grow in your region to help set up other growers and yourself to be more successful.
That's true. I developed what I call a topless high tunnel. It's not a truly topless high tunnel, but it reverses the standard high tunnel design where the top is a solid plastic covering and the sides are opened either through rolling up or dropping down to allow the ventilation system. And that design works very well in certain areas, but for the central states where we have extreme heat, wind, not enough rain typically, it was counterproductive. It did provide a protected space, but it created a huge amount of work for the operator to try to ventilate properly, to try to irrigate. It ended up causing more harm than good. And so I developed through just common sense. In my opinion, it was, I need wind protection on the sides at the plant level. I need to allow the airflow through the top and allow precipitation to come in. And so I reversed that design and created the topless high tunnel. It's very, very successful. It's just amazingly useful. Eliminates all the labor involved in using a high tunnel, but gives you all the benefits.
First of all, congratulations. That sounds wonderful for the part of the country you're in. Are you using a shade fabric on the top?
No.
Or just open?
It's a permeable netting, which does not create any shade. It acts as almost like a very thin layer of cloud. It does block some of the intensity of the sun, but there's no shade. So you're getting the full benefit of the sun's importance to make your plants healthy and full of nutrition. Whereas I understand once you start putting shade cloth on, you are losing some of those benefits of the solar power.
And did you source this fabric or material, Alice, through the horticulture industry or just go out on your own to find something?
Well, when I built the first topless high tunnel, this product was not available and I used just bird netting. Found out that a single layer of that netting did not stop hail from coming through and I had holes in my beautiful cabbages. So I laid a second layer. So I had one that went over the hoops and then a horizontal layer a little above head height. That allowed a double layer for hail to be blocked. This netting that I'm using now, and it is absolutely ideal, I sourced through Greenhouse Megastore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only source I have found for it. Now, there may be other sources, but I haven't been looking recently. But it's a very nicely flexible woven material that stretches well. So when you're putting it on the high tunnel, you can pull it down snug. but it's not, it's only secured along the sides with the channel iron and the wiggle wire, just like you put the plastic on.
Yeah.
So there's some flex in it. And if we've had several hailstorms here to test it, and it just bounces the hail off like a trampoline. It seems to work beautifully for that, but it allows all the rain to come through at a softened, it breaks up the drops, so the plants aren't beaten with heavy rain.
Question, just for clarity, is the side polyethylene?
Yeah, it's just a regular plastic that you would use to cover a high tunnel.
Several of the guests, Peter, that you've brought on have been businesses that produce products for small growers. And you've talked about how often either the price point at the is too high, and so these companies make it more accessible, or they have a scale or size that is important to these smaller operations. And I think that's where Alice's high tunnel comes in. It might be common sense to you. It is obviously innovative and makes a big difference, but it's a small market, so nobody's taken the time to investigate it. And so by you finding this advantage and sharing the information and the opportunity, like, you are improving these other businesses. And so that really fits in my head where we've talked about the trickle down of technology. We need people to invest in it. And whether you're investing in it because you're personally invested in your community and this is a fun, you know, activity for you, or you're invested in it because it's a multi-billion dollar market and that's where you want your business to go, like, you end up at the same place. So I really appreciated that as well.
Well, thank you. And, you know, when you were talking about trickle-down effects, that's why I wrote this book. I thought this is the only way that I can disseminate this information to others. And it's a self-published on Amazon KDP Publishing. It's not a nice, slick, professional quality of the information is there. And it's true life experiences. One of the things that people could know is that this was funded through the NRCS Equip High Tunnel Initiative. So we took a bit of a challenge to see whether or not they would accept it, because it is a unique concept. It ticked all the boxes that they had on their standard of practice, but it did not necessarily fit their concept of what a high tunnel should look like. Our NRCS representative here in Russell County, he went out on a limb for me, and now there's two on my place and one on a neighbor's place, and it's my hope that we will see a lot more of these in the central states: Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, the places where wind, heat, hail, extremes of temperature are real factors. Now in the Northeast, I don't see any benefit of this type of design, but there's a large chunk of the nation that could really benefit from the concept.
I've worked with greenhouse distributors over the course of my career, Alice, and every one of them that I've worked with has made the same comment, that the highest profit margin is with their smallest accounts.
Yes.
So while they consider it very exciting to nail down a big grower and a big order, they know that there's very little profit there. It's more just to keep wheels turning. But it's through us, the smaller growers, that some of this health and profit margin is located.
That's fabulous. And truthfully, what we need is a company to step up and recognize that this is a viable and very, very useful tool. And we need a kit, because many people are uncomfortable with putting things together. My husband and I are kind of good at this sort of thing, but the majority of people, they want to buy a prepackaged system that everything is in place, instead of buying from this company and figuring out measurements and all of the things that it required.
You're producing the crops, right? So you're spending some money to produce the crops, which is helping the economic activity, and people are spending money to buy the crops. And so that's great. But once you get that base, then you start to see investment. Then you see more people putting up high tunnels. You find somebody that's willing to drive a truck to move the produce around where it needs to go, and a system builds around it. And so I think that this connection that you're making between you're offering the produce, right? You've done your research. You think that, or you know that people are going to show up. People are showing up, and there just needs to be a first mover, because you were the first mover. You showed that there's some viability, and now there's five tunnels. There's going to be other things, and that's how we see change.
That's right. It's a lovely concept that this will act as an impetus, a stimulus for all of these small towns to have just what they need, and exactly right.
I'm going to put my Michelle cap on, my economist cap on, for a question now, Michelle. Alice, we're into the conversation as far as we are. I feel like I should have asked this question earlier. But from a business standpoint, the economics of this, and learning now that you and I are in similar stages in our lives, we've raised our families, we have grandchildren, we're not retired, but we're approaching those years. So I'm going to ask you, at the level of production that you're practicing, is your effort, you and your husband's sole source of income? If a younger couple came on board and said, gee, we like what you're doing, one of my questions to Michelle is going to be, well, how much are they going to have to grow? How big are they going to have to be to have to rely on this effort as their sole source, their career? Can you fill in any of those questions?
I can, and that's multi-layered question. So first answer is, no, this is not our only source of income, but that's neither here nor there, really. And I'm not doing this, I did not start this as a source of income for us. I hope not to lose money, but I'm certainly doing more than breaking even currently. But my goal was to create a legacy, I guess. It's not about me, but it's about my beliefs that we need to reclaim our food sovereignty in small communities. Mm-hmm. So that's why I have all this passion and willingness to work harder than I really want to at this point in life to get it done, because I believe in it. And maybe it won't happen while I'm still alive, but I believe that I've started that little spark that might end up becoming a nice forest fire someday. Okay. Second of all, how much would a young family have to get going? Well, first of all, in our area here in Kansas, the average farm now is somewhere around 1,000 or more acres. It is impossible for a young family to get started. Even if they inherit from parents, the debt load is so extreme, and the ability to repay that, basically you are signing on for, I will work my entire life for a bank, because all you're going to be doing is making interest payments. You might live decently, but you're not going to have what the American young family expects to have if you go into a commercial farm. With what my concept shows is that on 5 acres, you could live very well, enjoy yourself very well, and not have that debt load to start with that cripples you the rest of your life. Do I have the exact numbers on that? I don't. But what I can tell you is that in our community, there's about a total of 1,000 people in our 4 townships. These are just general average folks. Nobody out here is wealthy. We're not in an Estes Park community, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but the average person spends $4,000 a year on food. So if you multiply that $4,000 per person times 1,000 people, there's a huge potential for solid income, but it has to be year round. So we need a processing kitchen so that you take the summer produce and the meat and the grains and you create ready to use meals. People want convenience. I've heard over and over again, I don't cook anymore. Well, that's a real shame, but you don't have to if somebody does it for you, but using local ingredients. So there would be a multi-layered ability for a grower to not just sell fresh produce that's taken home and processed, but also they sell to the commercial kitchen that then converts it into ready-to-use, frozen, canned. We become our own grocery stores.
Michelle, this is this is all fascinating on how an idea like this can be cultivated and turn into or contribute to this overarching goal or objective of returning some of our national agriculture to its roots, to the community.
I agree. For your last question, I would also just point out with that family, if they're producing 5 acres, they are hopefully one of the 10 families that are eating from here. And so as a personal, my dad sold meat and dairy as a kid. And in, I don't know, kindergarten or second grade, I was asked to make a family budget. And I asked my mom how much she spends at the grocery store. She told me $100 a month. And the teacher called my parents and was like, "Are you eating?" And part of it was that my dad brought home everything. And so one of the pieces to consider is, instead of being paid in dollars, especially if this is not the only source of income, and with food prices where they are, and with the constant concern that fresh fruit is more expensive, are you feeding your family for a fraction of the cost and therefore overall reducing your budget? So that would just be my plug of an interesting way to look for it. Alice, is there anything else you wanted to add? I think that we could probably talk all day, but I want to make sure that you cover or get out anything else that you've been thinking of or want to share.
I just want to share with your audience, but that if anybody has any interest in either the topless high tunnel concept or the strategies for feeding little towns, I am more than willing to share what I know and what I hope to know. And I'm always ready to learn something new as well.
Alice, it's refreshing to see someone of my generation, and we're not so tired and worn out that we're giving up. We see a future. We want to make this world a better place for our grandchildren and Michelle's children. And I tip my cap to you. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a little bit, and I wish you the best.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. It was great to meet you both as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and the Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@stratagerm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.